I don't wanna be the boy that runs in the back. I don't wanna be the kid that falls in the dark. All I really want to be is the guy that gets that girl.
Welcome to the AJ Steele Show. We discuss politics, sex, money, and everything in between. And now, here's your host, an immigrant, a self-made millionaire, an American, AJ Steele.
Welcome to the AJ Steele Show. I don't do a lot of personal stories because most people I know don't like their names out there for everyone to hear, especially on a popular conservative show, because many times there's absolute hell to pay for it. Many folks on the left are completely unhinged and can be full of hate and extreme vengefulness against anyone they may disagree with. But today's episode got started with my wife. So in the hope that she accepts my heartfelt apologies and still cooks dinner tonight, here goes. My wife, Mrs. Steele, who was extremely young in the early 1970s, has only two memories of her oldest brother. One was sitting on his lap during Christmas 1973, and the next one was attending his funeral about a week later. He was all of 19 years old. You see, he was shot through a window while visiting a friend who belonged to law enforcement. He didn't know his killer. I doubt he ever met him. He was just a good Catholic kid with a dream to become a farmer and to raise lots of cattle. But none of that mattered to the black Muslim lowlife who shot him dead that night. In his eyes, my wife's brother has committed the greatest crime of all crimes, a mortal sin. He was born white. Now, almost 50 years later, my wife picks up a book at a bookstore, and the title of the book is 5 Henry 7. On the cover, it mentions the zebra killers, the same black animals who murdered her brother and countless other innocent white folks in the San Francisco Bay Area. But this book was about a lot more. It was written by a man named Frank Falzon, a San Francisco homicide inspector who was also responsible for the capture of the devil-worshipping night stalker Richard Ramirez and the investigation into the famous, or I should say infamous, Zodiac killer, not to mention the shocking murder of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. He's the one you all heard about. He's the newly christened patron saint of all gays and gay pedophile enablers. Now, this in particular was a very interesting case because the killer, Dan White, who just happened to be one of Mr. Falzon's best friends, also happened to be one of the only conservative members of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, a man constantly smeared and unfairly attacked by leftist politicians and media right here in California for just trying to do the right thing for his constituents. Sounds familiar? You know, the more things change as time passes, the more they remain exactly the same. Now, getting back to our story, my wife enjoyed this book so much that she bought an extra copy for her 91-year-old dad, and he loved it so much that he told me all about it. And that's when I decided that I have to interview the author, who happens to live right in the same county as I do. A lot of you out there remember movies about San Francisco detectives like Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry. Go ahead, make my day. Or Steve McQueen's Bullet. Crazy, crazy car chase. Probably still the greatest car chase I've ever seen. But how many of us ever get to talk to the real thing? The real McCoy? The real men of flesh and blood who protect all of us from all of the evil psychotics and drug addicts who lurk in the dark and destroy the lives of innocents. Well, Frank Falzon, the man I'm going to talk to in a couple of minutes, is exactly this type of a man. He's a tough, no-nonsense man of law, but he also happens to be a genuinely nice person who really cared about all the victims of crime and who remembers everything he did on duty as a 28-year veteran of the SFPD. Talking to him, I thought about crime and murder and how the use of illegal drugs is involved in almost all of them. And then I thought about folks like my wife's mom and dad and brothers and sisters whose lives were altered forever when their family members were murdered. I also thought about men like San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk, a proud gay man who, as far as I know, had a sordid history of hanging out with young boys and teenage runaways who ended up on the streets of San Francisco. I've always believed that pedophiles are just as bad as murderers because they kill the souls of the children that they abuse. And I've always felt that they deserve to die or to be locked up for the rest of their lives. Now, I'm not saying that Harvey Milk should have been murdered, but if he was a pedophile, did he deserve to live? Finally, I thought about the ugly nature of politics and race relations and the fact that the wanton murder of white people by black Muslims was practically covered up even in the 70s to protect the feelings of certain black people and maybe their virtue signaling white political enablers. I thought about all of these things and I asked Mr. Falzon all the questions. Sometimes the answers I got were straight, and sometimes the answers, or the meaning, the true meaning of the answers, are to be found in what he purposely did not say. So yes, we have a great show coming up, and it actually includes some questions that our listeners wanted me to ask him. But before we get on with my interview with this fascinating man, who happens to be a great storyteller, I wanted to thank all of you for your continued listenership and social media friendship, and to remind you to please subscribe to our show if you haven't done so already. We're on iTunes, we're on Spotify, and all the other major podcast providers. And like I keep telling you, our show, which is completely self-financed and completely free to you, keeps growing and growing. As a matter of fact, we keep hitting top 40 on the ratings charts on 4 different continents, which absolutely blows my mind. I understand why people here in the US would listen to us, but people in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, and even Australia just love our show. And I would love it if we could hit top 10 all over the world. So please don't forget to spread the word about us to all of your friends and family and keep listening. Our interview with former SFPD homicide inspector Frank Falzon will be coming right up. This is the AJ Steele Show. All I really want to
be is the guy that gets the girl. The AJ Steele Show. Think of your loudmouth best friend, hated by all the wives, because he tells it just like it is. You finally see your love
belongs to me. Welcome to the AJ Steele Show, Mr. Falzon. Like I was telling you earlier, my wife recently bought your new book, 5 Henry 7, and she liked it so much that she got a copy for her 91-year-old dad, and he enjoyed it so much that he practically devoured it. They both have a tragic connection to the black Muslim zebra killers, which you investigated in the early 70s, and whom we'll talk about a little bit later. But you had a wonderful career as a San Francisco murder investigator, and I bet you must have seen and heard just about everything. What are your thoughts about the state of the crime and lawlessness in San Francisco these days?
Well, what I'm witnessing, and it's horrific. We were on the right path, right direction, as far as cleaning up the police department, cleaning up the city. Everything was going into a positive direction until the city changed course. And I put it back to diversity. And I think we all agree diversity is a great thing. But when you lower standards to get to that diversity, you're not helping anybody or anyone. In fact, you're actually hurting a city, and you're hurting a police department, and you're hurting a country. Yes, education is wonderful. I'm all for, you know, local colleges being opened up to anybody and everybody at no cost. City colleges, that's what they're there for. Community colleges give everybody an education. And those that want to strive, they can go on and have a higher degree. But what we're witnessing today is totally out of control.
Not to mention that many of our current politicians on the left are anti-police. Now, something you and my audience may not know is that both my dad and my uncle were police detectives themselves. And so I know a little bit about the dangers and pitfalls that come with the job. But with all of the insanity going on these days, you know, the defund the police movement and even the higher ups in government who are attacking law enforcement day and night, would you even consider joining the police force today?
You know, I absolutely love my job as a homicide detective. I thought it was the epitome of police work, and I believed in what I was doing, and I felt sorry for the victims of crime. But today, the victims of crime are the forgotten people. When you read in the newspaper about victims, they talk about numbers. What they don't realize is those numbers are real people that have their life tragically disrupted. And my job, I got to meet those people personally, and it's very, very sad. And the sad thing about San Francisco is such a beautiful, beautiful city. And having been born and raised there, and I grew up in San Francisco, I went to high school. San Francisco, played sports in the city.
Wow.
I love San Francisco. The only reason I'm now living outside of the city is because of my wife and my career and my life being threatened. And my wife said, "You're just too close to the flames. I want out of the city. Otherwise, I'd still be there." Nothing like San Francisco.
Oh, it's a beautiful place, and I don't blame you at all for leaving. What is it? The Rolling Stones had a song in the 60s called "Sympathy for the Devil," and one of my favorite lyrics in it was, "Every cop is a criminal, and all the sinners, saints." And it sure seems like that's the world we live in today. Sympathy for the devil. Do you think it's more difficult to be a police officer today than it was back when you got started?
I would say 100% with certainty that today it's much more difficult on the policeman because they can't be a policeman. What I'm seeing and what I'm hearing is that they go from one run to another run. They become glorified newspaper reporters. They make reports, and then the tour of duty is over. My day, we sought out crime. We were proactive. We would have informants. We would know when a crime was going to go down, and we would be there, and we would disrupt the crime and catch the criminal. It was a great job. We had camaraderie. The job got done. We were well paid for our work. And that era of the cop on the take, in my days, it was over. And righteously so. I mean, they were paying us well. And there was no need for any kind of skullduggery. There will always be the bad cop, and you'll always read about the bad cop. But fortunately, the people I worked with, 99% of them, were just everyday, good, honest people doing a great job.
Wow. Yeah, those were different times, I guess. I know that everybody wants to hear about the Night Stalker, especially since the release of that extremely popular Netflix series you were featured in, where they covered his gruesome murders and how your excellent work led to the arrest and the ultimate conviction of this monster. But I wanted to start by talking about a couple of your other famous cases first. One of them was in the early 70s when four black Muslim nationalists, later called zebra killers, went around San Francisco and Sacramento just murdering innocent white people for the heck of it. One of the likely victims was my wife's 19-year-old brother, who was shot in the back for the crime of being white. Can you tell us a little bit about this case and how you helped solve it?
In the 70s, it was going to work to find out what was the next big case that would pop up. And it was crazy. We had the SLA, we had the Black Panthers, we had the Zebra, the Zodiac. It was insane. Patty wow. Hearst. It was just one big case after another. I was honored to be in the unit and to work those big cases. And with the Zebra, unfortunately, because of the subject matter, black versus white, it was downplayed all over the country, except San Francisco had to cover it because it was a very, very frightening, scary situation. Now, the Zodiac case gets all kinds of media, all kinds of hype. And there's truly probably only one case that we can link to the Zodiac. It's the Paul Stein cab driver case. I know there's other cases in the North Bay that are linked to the Zodiac, but definitely the Paul Stein cab driver case was the Zodiac. So that's one murder. We had 15 murders that we know of. And historians now say during that period of time, the Zebra killers were responsible for close to 72 murders. Very, very sad. And one night, the sun was setting. My partner and I, it was a beautiful night. We're out driving, working one of our homicide cases. And just when we were on Haight Street, we got to the cross street of Herman, we heard gunshots, and my partner says, Frank, those are shots. I said, you're damn right, Jack. It sounds like it's right around the corner. Jack turns the corner, and there's this car halfway into the driveway at UC Extension down near Market Street, and a lovely young white girl is hanging out of the open passenger door. She had just been shot. And Jack immediately jumps out, runs to her. I start to run after my partner. And it dawns on me, I'm useless. So I go back to the radio car and I put out the hottest call on the police radio. 406, woman's just been shot. Suspect's still in the area. Code 3 ambulance. What that basically told everybody in the city that was in a police car, we want you to respond to the area of Herman and Haight Street.
Got it.
Cars were swarming in everywhere, and they grabbed an individual. It happened to be, in the end, the first actual arrest in the Zebra killings, a man by the name of Jesse Lee Cooks. I got a confession from him. It wasn't much of a confession, but it was enough to convince the courts and the jury that he was one of the leaders in the Zebra killings.
Well, how did you get the confession out of him?
Well, we took him into the interrogation room, and I sat him down, and I was alone. There was two uniformed officers outside the door. I had put my revolver in the desk drawer and locked it up. So it was just him and I. I had the tape recorder, and I explained to Jesse Cooks that we had overwhelming evidence. We had the murder weapon. I found I think it was about 12 or 13 rounds of live ammunition that would be matched up to the bullets taken from the victim. And either he wanted to give me a statement or just go upstairs and be booked murder one. He looked at me, he said, no, I'll tell you. I shot her because she called me, and he used the N-word.
Of course.
I said, oh, come on. That little girl. He says, yeah, man, she called me the N-word, and I got heated and upset, and I shot her. Well, I knew it was BS. The jury knew it was BS. And bottom line, he was convicted of murder in the first degree. He died in San Quentin.
Well, that kind of BS actually might fly with juries today. Now, I've read that people in San Francisco were completely panicked, and that many blacks and so-called civil rights groups, they were up in arms when the police started profiling young black males. Let me ask you a simple question. What's wrong with profiling people? For example, doesn't it make sense to profile men with beards, guys that look just like me, at airports, and not 80-year-old grandmothers flying to visit their grandkids in Iowa?
Well, the relationship, and it's truly sad, because I got to see both sides of the coin. And a lot of these absolutely wonderful, wonderful people are trapped in the project areas, tenements that are crime-riddled, and yeah. They want to help the police. They want to be involved with the police. But they look at you with tears in their eyes and they say, Inspector, what do you think will happen to me if I turn on my neighbor? And I would look at him and my heart would break for him, because it's true. But what they don't realize is, without cooperation, the police are not going to be successful. We need everybody to pitch in. I mean, we got some serious problems going on. But what I witnessed, in the last few years, ever since the George Floyd killing, has been a nightmare. The police are put in handcuffs. The criminals are told, well, you can steal up to $1,000, and it's only a misdemeanor. So you tell somebody that, and they're a criminal, they're going to commit crime, and they're going to get away with it.
It's unbelievable. In your opinion, were racial tensions worse in the 1970s than they are today, or is this just a cyclical kind of thing?
Race relationships throughout my career have always been a hot button. What I saw in the police department was the diversity. And I have to be honest with you, I came to accept it, except I just didn't agree with the way it was being handled. I remember my last day on the job. I was called over by one of the deputy chiefs. He wanted to wish me best and shake my hand. And I sat in on a meeting with all the brass, and they were very, very excited. And when they all left, I looked at my buddy. I said, "What the hell was that about?" And he says, "You know, Frank, they were excited because the next candidate to be promoted was not only Asian, she was a woman, and she was a lesbian. Check three boxes. I looked at him. I said, "Are you serious? Nobody talked about what type of boss she would make. What was her achievements as a police officer?" That's how much the police department changed from my day, where you didn't do police work, you weren't promoted.
You see that in fire departments now. You see it in the government. Heck, I mean, look at our Vice President Kamala Harris. And you don't have to comment on that. But seriously, we have incompetence in positions of power because of their race or their sex or their sexual orientation. Let me take a short break, and when we get back, I'm going to ask you about another important case that you are involved in.
You are listening to the AJ Steele Show, where no topic is off limits, no discussion too harsh, no truth more true. The AJ Steele Show, we tell it like it is.
Welcome back to the AJ Steele Show. Mr. Falzon, another important murder case that you were involved with led to the famous Twinkie defense. In 1978, a former police officer and a good friend of yours, Dan White, shot and killed San Francisco Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk, who has recently become the patron saint of all gays in America. Tell us about this case. How did you get involved, and what did the killer, Dan White, tell you?
Now, I think history will tell you Dan White and I were very, very close. We had gone to the same grammar school. He was younger than me. We both played baseball. Baseball was our life. And when I was growing up, I was the guy that would shag the balls for the older boys that were part of the University of California varsity baseball team. Well, I didn't know it, but Dan White, years later, was shagging balls for me. He was one of these little kids that hang around, idolize the older boys. And I totally forgot about him until one day I started a softball league in the police department. Because when I went into the police department, I realized there was a drinking culture. If you didn't drink, you weren't trusted. Cops drank, and it wasn't a good thing. So I started a softball league, and it really caught on like wildfire. And everybody, every station had a team. It was very, very competitive. I was a so-called commissioner, and we would play at all the different parks in the city. This one day, a young guy walks up to me, nice-looking young man, with a glove under his arm and a pair of spikes over his shoulders. And he says, "Hi, Frank, I want to play on your team." I said, "You can't. You have to be a policeman." "I am a policeman." "Well, you have to work out of Northern Station." "Frank, I do work out of Northern Station. Don't you remember me?" And then he enlightened me about being the young boy that grew up chasing fly balls for us. And then at the end of the day, we let him hit high school pitching.
Wow.
And he was very appreciative. I started him at second base. And oh my God, he was best player in the department by far. He ended up being our shortstop. And later on, I would take an all-star team statewide, and we would win two state titles. And Dan White was the MVP both years. So we had a very close relationship. I would say I was his big brother. He was a kid brother. The tragic day when Malcolm Moscone got shot, I was the on-call inspector.
Wow.
And if you remember, 10 days earlier was the Jonestown mass shootings.
That's right.
And the Chronicle had run several stories, which I had read, that stated that the disciples that escaped were coming to San Francisco to take out crooked politicians.
Wow.
So as I'm heading up to City Hall, I'm 100% certain I'm going to be investigating a Jim Jones disciple. Well, we arrive at City Hall, my partner Herman Clark and I, and we run up the stairs, and at the top of the stairs, second story, I run into the bodyguard, the mayor's bodyguard, Jim Molinari, sergeant. I said, "Hey, Jim, what's going on?" He says, "Frank, the mayor's dead." This is the first time now I'm getting confirmation the mayor's dead. And I have to be honest with you, it was like a blow to your head because you're the case investigator and the mayor's just been murdered. And I looked at Jim. I said, "Jim, do we have a suspect?" He says, "Yes, Dan White." Well, I mean, it was like, wow. And I immediately flashed back a year or so earlier, Dan White coming to my office, walks in my office. He says, "Frank, I want you to be the first to know." I said, "Know what, Dan?" He said, "I'm going to run for city supervisor, our old neighborhood." I said, "Oh, Jesus, Dan, you don't want to go up to that cesspool. You don't want to be up there. That's not where cops or firemen belong. We're simple people. We can't talk out about both sides of our mouth. It just doesn't work for us." "Oh, no, 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 no. I'm looking forward to it, Frank." I said, "Dan, how could you win an election?" He says, "Frank, I'll tell you, very easy. I'm going to walk every neighborhood in our district, Visitation Valley and San Bruno Avenue." He said, "I'm going to knock on every door and I'm going to tell them I'm going to represent you and I'll do what's best for the community." I'll be damned, he got elected and he was a supervisor. And initially, him and Harvey really hit it off. Dan was not, he went to the same schools. He had a Catholic upbringing. He was not a homophobic individual. He believed in people being fair, in Dan White's mind, fair. Mm. And Harvey was coming from a different fairness. Mm-hmm. And eventually that brotherly friendship that they had dissipated very badly.
So was Dan White a nut, or did something horrible happen that led to all of these murders or executions, whatever you want to call them? Because I remember he quit his job as a supervisor and then he wanted to come back as a supervisor. What really happened over there?
What had happened up at City Hall is, unfortunately, Dan was a lot of pressure was put back on him. He made the right move. No ands, ifs, or buts about it. Mm. When he decided to quit and go back in the fire department, he was making $9,000 with a wife and a family. He couldn't support his family on that. Went back in the fire department, he would be making $36,000. So he made a great decision. I read that in the paper and I thought, good for you, Dan. I knew you never belonged at City Hall. But immediately, the Police Officers Association, the Fire Department Association, the Chamber of Commerce in San Francisco, these were all conservative groups. And they said, "Hey, Dan, you don't know what you're doing. We've been winning all these votes up at City Hall, 6-5. Mm. And you were that sixth vote. You can't leave us. We need you back. We'll subsidize you and help your salary, but go back and get your job." So he went and saw George Moscone, the mayor. And George was a very affable guy. He reminded me of Bill Clinton. He could speak and you believed him.
He was charming, huh? He was a charming man.
A very charming man. And he said to Dan, "You know, Dan, you're an athlete. You grew up here in the city. I was an athlete at St. Ignatius, USF. And, you know, Dan, you got your job back as far as I'm concerned. But I'm going to sit on it for a while and see what happens in the next few days." Mm. Well, as Dan is walking out that day that he was told he can have his job back, he overhears Harvey Milk, who had an office across from Dan, on the phone with Moscone, saying, "We don't want that conservative SOB. We want somebody of our own ilk." And Dan overheard that, and he knew that there was people on the left that were going to be playing against him. But he felt George was a man of his word, and he was going to get his job back. Well, so much pressure was put on to George that George, if George made any mistake in this whole episode, he should have called Dan and sat him down and told him the reality.
The truth. Yeah.
But never happened. And The day that the appointment was going to go down, Dan White's aide calls him and says at 11 o'clock today, you're not getting reappointed. The mayor is going to announce somebody else is going to replace you on the Board of Supervisors. And Dan says, well, I'm coming down right now. And after talking to Dan's wife, and he had turned himself into a hermit. He was locked up downstairs in his garage, basement apartment. And he had all these articles out on the table about his hero father and how his father always did everything right. And I think Dan got pretty mixed up. When I say pretty mixed up, really mixed up.
Got it.
He had, was binging on junk food and Coca-Cola and all these crazy things. He was very depressed. He went down there and he strapped on his gun. And then when he got there, he climbed through a back window so he didn't have to go through the metal detector at the front door. And it, during the trial, it came out that that wasn't uncommon. Other supervisors knew about this window that you could hop through. So Dan went directly to the mayor, and he greeted Sir Copertini, the mayor's secretary, and she led him into the mayor's office. And the mayor says, you know, Dan, I'm not going to appoint you. Come on in my little, he had a little ante room in the mayor's office. He says, come on back here and I'll fix you a drink. And Dan White is thinking, I don't want a drink. I want to know why you're doing this to me and my family. And George starts to pour two drinks. It was either bourbon or scotch on the little table and two shot glasses. And the mayor was smoking a cigarette. And Dan said the more he talked, the more flushed he became. And his head, everything was swirling. And he says, next thing I took the gun out, I shot him.
The AJ Steele Show will be right back with much, much more.
AJ Steele, not right, not left, just right.
Don't float like Ollie, don't sing like Howard, and don't cry like a pussy.
Welcome back to our interview with homicide investigator and author Frank Falzon.
And he says, next thing I took the gun out, I shot him. And then he later admitted that he emptied his gun, reloaded, and went across the hall. And as he walked in on the other side, the supervisor's side, Mayor Dianne Feinstein, the eventual mayor after Moscone was shot and killed, she hollers, hey, Dan, I'd like to see you. He says, 1 minute, Dianne, I'll be right with you.
Wow.
He says, he opens Harvey's door. He says, come into my office. I'd like to talk to you. And Harvey came in and he says, all he did was smirk at me and kind of laugh like, we got you. And he says, I lost it again. And I shot Harvey. And that's it. He says, I was going to kill myself. And I went to the phone down at Doggy Diner.
I remember that place.
Golden Gate in Van Ness. And I knew there was a phone there from my days in the police department. I called my wife and I said, you know, I'm going to kill myself. But she said, please, Dan, don't. Mm-hmm. Don't kill yourself. Turn yourself in to St. Mary's Cathedral. I'll be right there. She rushed down, talked him into turning himself into Northern Station. Minutes later, I'm in the interrogation room taking his statement.
Wow.
Now, I don't want to belabor this, but did it seem to you, you knew him, like a man who snapped? Was this a rash decision? Was this just culmination of a lot of things, a lot of anger over the years?
Well, it was an investigation like none other I ever had. I told the boss and the guys in the unit, I said, I have to dot every I and cross every T, and I want all of you to help me. If you could think of anything I have to cover, please tell me. We can't make a mistake on this one because we'll be scrutinized. And I was, and my investigation was. But I was satisfied that it was about as complete as humanly possible. And when the trial went down, I have to give credit to Doug Schmid, the defense attorney, and his right arm, a man named Stephen Scheer. I can still see it like it was yesterday. I'm sitting there with Tom Norman, the prosecutor, Tommy was the absolute best in the San Francisco Police District Attorney's Office. I'm sitting there with him, and Joe Freitas, the DA, walks in, sits down between the two of us. He doesn't look at his prosecutor. He looks at me, and he says, "Frank, what do you think the jury's going to bring in?" I said, "I'm going to tell you like I feel, Joe." I said, "Sitting here throughout the trial, I personally feel they're going to give a break to George Moscone. That's going to be voluntary manslaughter because he acted out in the heat of passion." I said, "But the fact that he emptied his gun, reloaded, went downstairs, walked over to Harvey, called Harvey into his office, and shot Harvey, as far as I'm concerned, that's first-degree murder."
True.
And Tom Norman got visibly upset with me. He says, "Joe, Frank's got it all wrong. It's going to be two first-degree murder cases."
Two.
And we were the so-called experts. And neither Tom nor I got it right, because the jury returned two manslaughter verdicts. And then we had the White Knight riots. Dan served out his sentence, which was less than, I think, 6 years. It was a crazy sentence. And Dan White was very smart. He knew he was going to go to the gas chamber. He confessed to two murders. Nobody should get off on two murders.
I agree. Nobody. I agree.
So he is now a free man. He's hiding out down in L.A., and everybody in San Francisco is trying to find out, where is Dan White? And the media was relentless. They were dogging every move he made. I got a phone call one night at home, and I knew right away it was Dan. He was on parole, hiding out in the Los Angeles area. He says, "Frank, I'd like to talk to you." I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "I really want to talk to you." I said, "I got a lot of questions in my head." So I flew down to L.A. on my own, paid my own fare, met Dan White, spent 3 days with him. His family had purchased tickets to the Olympics, 84 Olympics. And we went to some track and field events. We went to some boxing matches. Dan had been a gold glove boxer, I think, with the Olympic Club. He was a champion. He's a tough kid. And one day, we're out in the Coliseum courtyard, and there was one of those trucks that was selling food. And we went over and we got a hot dog, Coke, and chips. We sat down at a table, and I looked at Dan. I said, "You know, Dan, I have a lot of questions. I haven't asked you any. Everything's been pretty light up to this point.
Yeah.
But did I miss anything in my investigation? Was I as thorough as I thought I was?" He says, "Oh, my God, Frank, I really lost it that day, didn't I?" Mm-hmm. I looked at him. I said, "Jesus, Dan, that's putting it mildly. Yes, you really lost it." He says, "Well, it could have been a lot worse. And now I'm stunned." I said, "What do you mean a lot worse?" He says, "I wanted four people that day." Now he's basically telling me it was premeditated.
Premeditated. He didn't lose it. Exactly. Wow.
He says, "Do you remember I had a pocket full of bullets?" I said, "You did." He says, "Well, I had five bullets for four people." And I said, "Who were the other two?" He said, "Well, I wanted George. I wanted Harvey. I was going to get Willie Brown." He says, "Willie Brown was the puppeteer. He was pulling the strings on George." And he said, "Carol Ruth Silver." Now, I know nothing about Carol. I said, "Why Carol Ruth Silver?" He says, "She was the biggest snake of the bunch."
And interesting.
I never asked another question. I was floored. That day, he says, and the 21st bullet was for me. He said, "Marianne talked me out of taking my own life." And I said, "Oh, Dan, this is all so sick, so sad. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." But I could see he was living a living hell between the 6 inches between his ears. He put himself in a prison that there was no way out. And soon thereafter, a Chronicle reporter named Susan Sward, she wanted to take me to lunch. And we're sitting at the luncheon counter, sitting across from each other, and she says, "You know, Frank, do you feel right? Do you feel it's right that your friend Dan White is free and George Moscone is dead. Harvey Milk is dead. And I said, oh, my God, no, I don't feel that's right at all. And I said, I'll guarantee you, Dan White knows it wasn't right. And the final chapter has not been written. I said, Dan White is living in a worse prison than any of us can put him into. And sure as hell, a month or so later, I'm called. I'm back on call again. And I'm the cop that responds to his suicide.
Wow.
What a tragedy, a true tragedy for the people that he killed, for himself, for his friends, and especially for his family and his children. Now, thinking about what you said about Willie Brown, that's an incredible story because had Willie Brown been killed, God forbid, none of us would probably ever hear of his later mistress, Kamala Harris. She would have never been a senator, which means she would have never been our vice president. And who knows, in the future, she might be our president. Unbelievable. Kind of a lot of ties here. And Willie Brown was a very, very powerful man, very intelligent man, too. Still is, as a matter of fact. So,
well, what I know about Willie, and I go all the way back to the Fillmore days when I was working with a young, energetic police officer by the name of Eddie Erlatz. The two of us had the Fillmore beat, and Willie was working the pimps and prostitute, defending them, along with his crime partner, John Dearman, who became a judge. I had a lot of respect for Willie and John because those two men really elevated the black community in my eyes. I think if somebody, and I could have been the person, or Dianne Feinstein, had been able to talk to Dan White, we could have talked sense to him, where none of this would have ever happened. But Dan was only talking to one person, and that was himself. And he wasn't giving himself the right information.
So, like you said, Dianne Feinstein ended up becoming the mayor of San Francisco and eventually our congresswoman. But in the last 10 years or so, this whole case spawned the legend of Harvey Milk, who was a true scumbag as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there was a major movie made about him, and they have stamps, and there's a Navy ship, and even the San Francisco airport is named after him. And he's being celebrated by all the lefties in California as a hero. But let me ask you a sensitive question. Before they sanitized and made Harvey Milk into a saint, wasn't he just a creepy predator who used to pick up young boys and teenage runaways? Growing up in San Francisco, I heard about this from several sources, and I still remember seeing some photos of him with his young men that for some reason you just can't find on Google anymore. They've been scrubbed. Was he a predator or not?
There's no ands, ifs, or buts. Harvey is today's martyr in the gay community. And he's glorified, and any tragedies that occurred in his life are forgotten. When Dan White put a bullet in his head, he put a bullet in every closet, in every gay closet in America. And once they were out, you cannot say anything negative about Harvey. He is their saint, and Saint Harvey does nothing wrong.
That's a very fair answer. Mr. Falzon, I'm going to take a short break, and when we get back, we will talk about the Night Stalker. I am AJ Steele, and this is the AJ Steele Show.
The AJ Steele Show. Think of your loudmouth best friend, hated by all the wives, because he tells it just like it is.
Welcome back, Mr. Falzon. We just got through discussing some of your most important cases, which you expand on in your excellent book, 5 Henry 7. But we obviously can't ignore your most famous case, the Night Stalker. Tell our listeners a little bit about who this monster named Richard Ramirez was and how it was that you, of all people, came to identify him and bust this whole case wide open.
Well, initially, we were not involved. This was a terror in the Los Angeles greater area, Orange County, Glendale. The Night Stalker was hitting those areas. And at that time, he was called the Walk-In Killer and the Valley Intruder. Those were the names the paper came up for him. And then one day in August, it was a very hot day, We get a call, my partner Carl Klotz and I, and we respond out to Eucalyptus Avenue, out by Sloat and Harding Golf Course. Beautiful neighborhood, manicured lawns, nice homes. And we pull up in front of a house, very well cared for. And my first thought was, well, husband and wife, something went bad. I was told that two people had been shot, one dead. Well, you never know what you're going to walk into. And I first get there, the captain of police was standing on the lawn talking to a reporter. My crime lab investigator had already gone over to the point of entry, which was a lower window at ground level. And it was a Toyota tire iron he pried the window open with. He left shoe prints, climbed into the downstairs garage, came up to the staircase inside the house. Well, he entered the garage and then took the staircase on the inside to the upstairs level. It was a two-story home. Once he entered the upstairs level, he headed right towards the master bedroom. He shot the husband, killed him instantly, and then he shot the wife. And as she was moaning and whimpering, he had sex with her. Apparently didn't complete the act, but the sick animal, and we have been reading about the LA cases where this guy was a devil worshiper and whatnot, but we were not making a connection at this point. This animal went into their kitchen after committing these brutal acts, opened up their refrigerator, ate their leftovers from dinner, drank some milk, regurgitated on their kitchen floor. He then went into the living room area, and with a knife, he etched into the wall about a 2-foot circle with a big star in the middle. It's a pentagram, the symbol of the devil. And he stood there and pleasured himself, completing his sexual satisfaction, and left a puddle on the floor. Sick, demented individual. And then he gathered up a bunch of items from the house, and particularly Mrs. Pan, who was the female victim, along with her husband, Peter Pan, took their jewelry and walked out and left. We didn't know what we had at that point. And we went down to the office and we put out an all points bulletin regarding everything on our case. The crime lab technician pointed out to us several casings of an automatic weapon that were on the floor when he shot both victims. And those casings had a very, very unique primer. It was a pink primer around the head of the bullet.
Got it.
And we put that in our teletype. And I think it was Monday. This all happened Sunday, Monday. My partner, Carl Klotz, got a phone call from Glendale Police Department, a very dedicated detective by the name of John Perkins. John tells Carl, I'm working a similar case down here, and Carl's listening, and they're describing everything that happened. And then John Perkins says, we have casings with a pink primer. And as soon as he says pink primer, Carl lights up like a Christmas tree.
Got it.
He tells me, and immediately we get the ballistic expert to fly down to Los Angeles to do some ballistic comparisons. We hit a home run. So we're now tied in all those murders down in Los Angeles and the Los Angeles greater area. So once the media picks up that San Francisco is linked to Los Angeles, he's now being called the Night Stalker. So my partner, Carl, and I, the first thing we did, we flew down. We spent 3 days down in L.A. And I'm gleaming everything, and so is my partner, from the detectives with the L.A. Police Department and the L.A. Sheriff's Department. One thing I can tell you is both agencies were working very hard, very diligent. They both had task force set up where leads were being followed up. And it seemed like both teams were doing the utmost. But one thing they weren't doing, they were not working together. Mm. In that jurisdiction, it's very obvious that you catch the worst killer ever, you get the publicity, you get the book, you get the movie rights. So they're not sharing with each other. But fortunately, they were sharing with Carl and I. And we gleaned everything. And the biggest thing we returned to San Francisco with is that the suspect had a first name of Rick. And what we were told by two Los Angeles Police Department detectives is that a solo motorcycle cop in LAPD made a stop of a Toyota. And he was known to steal Toyotas, use the tire iron to pry open windows. Stop is made. The officer asked to see ID. The only ID he could show was a dental card that said Rick, no last name. So the officer says, I'm going to have to take you in. He said, this is not identification. And at that time, the individual bolts, jumps a fence, runs through a park, and gets away, leaving the car there with the solo motorcycle cop. So the two LA homicide cops felt 100% certainty that Rick was the name of the suspect.
Got it.
So when I got back to San Francisco, I'd been thinking, what could we do to move this case forward? I pulled all the reports because I'm figuring if this guy is a burglar, he may have hit some houses where people weren't home and we might have evidence that can link him. Ironically, the house out on Baker off of the Marina Greens, owned by Dr. Saroyan and his wife Marie, a very prominent dentist in San Francisco, several days earlier had been hit by a burglar. There was a print found on the back window. And what we come to find out later is Rick had climbed through that bathroom window. Husband and wife were out to dinner. They had a niece and her girlfriend still in the house. They went downstairs. They had gone to sleep early. It saved their life because he's trashing everything upstairs, collecting all the valuables, dumping Marie Soroyan's valuable jewelry into a pillowcase and anything else he could find of value. And then we know later is he looked out the window and he saw a car in the driveway, which was Mr. and Mrs. Soroyan returning home.
Oh, wow.
And the reason we know that is because when the criminals went there, the drapes were pulled back. And Mr. and Mrs. Soroyan said, that's not the way we left the drapes when we went out. So when they're pulling into the garage and coming up the inside staircase, he's going down the outside staircase with a sack full of their valuables. The break comes in the case when the uniform officers, ironically, one of them happened to be my son, Dan Falzon. He went out and made a beautiful report. And in the report, he lists all the items that were stolen. And one of the items, Dr. Saroyan had put his driver's license number on the inside of a gold bracelet with diamonds he had given his wife. Mm. That bracelet ends up down in Lompoc. An informant turned it in to a Sergeant Harry Height in Lompoc Police Department. And so we get a hit that that bracelet's been recovered. So I called Sergeant Harry Height and we had a pleasant conversation. He says, look, I talked to your burglary detail. They said it's not the Night Stalker. And I said, well, I have to decide. It's my case. I want to talk to your informant. He said, well, let's get something straight, Inspector. I'm not giving you my informant. And I looked at him. I didn't look at him. I spoke to him, and I stood up at the desk. And I remember my voice got very loud because everybody in the detail is looking at me. I said, you know, Sergeant, I understand your predicament. You don't want to give up your informant. I'm going to make myself very clear right now. Something happens. And there's another person or persons murdered this weekend, and you could have prevented it. I personally will come down and put you in handcuffs. Do I make myself clear? He said, calm down, Inspector, calm down. If my informant wants to talk to you, he'll call you right back.
Mm.
Right off the phone, seconds later, the phone's ringing. It's the informant. He said, yes, that bracelet was given to my mother-in-law. Her name is Donna Myers. She lives over in San Pablo. She got the bracelet from her boyfriend, Armando, who gave $20 to Rick. Bingo, Rick.
See.
So I'm very excited. My partner, Carl, wasn't so sure we were onto anything concrete. I was 100% certain. I could just feel everything in my body building up. So I looked at Mike Mullane, another inspector that I really had a great deal of respect for. I said, Mike, I think this thing's going to blow up today. Would you mind coming with us?
The AJ Steele Show will be right back with the exciting conclusion of the Night Stalker case and some listener questions. Don't go anywhere.
You are listening to the AJ Steele Show, where no topic is off limits, no discussion too harsh, no truth more true. The AJ Steele Show, we tell it like it is.
So the three of us left heading over to San Pablo. We stopped in at the San Pablo Police Department, talked to the chief, great guy. He said, thank you for letting us know you're going to be working in our territory. I said, chief, do you have anybody you can send with us? Because, you know, you might as well have somebody involved in this from your department. He said, absolutely. So I'm going to give you my best man. Calls in a man named Detective George Spencer. So George Spencer and I get into the San Pablo car, and Carl and Mike Mullane are in the other car, and we head over to Donna Myers. And when we get to Donna Myers, it's unbelievable. Everything she says is spot on. He wears a baseball cap, ACDC. He wears a black jacket, members only. He has rotten teeth. All the stuff we had gleaned down in Los Angeles from witnesses.
Yeah.
It's all hidden. We're not missing anywhere. So I said, how do we find out Rick? She said, well, Rick is my boyfriend's best friend. Came from El Paso, Texas together. Who's your boyfriend? Armando Rodriguez. So next step is, Mike, would you stay here with Donna? I don't want her using the phone. And the San Pablo detective, Carl and I, we head over to El Sobrante. We get to Armando's house. It's set back up about 150 feet up a long driveway, and it's got a gated front. The gate's about 12 to 15 feet high, so there's no way to get in. So I look across the street, and fortunately, it's right where the El Sobrante Fire Department is. Walk across the street, the three of us, and we go in, and the fire department's very receptive, and they let us use their phone. I call Armando. I told him who I was. I said, I'm a homicide cop, and I have some very, very important news for you, and I think you should listen to it. He said, well, tell me. I said, no, I said, it's not something I can say over the phone. Come down to the gate. I'll meet you at the gate. So we walk back across the street. Sure as hell, here comes Armando, except he's got two Doberman pinchers on leashes, and when they get to the gate, these dogs are growling at me.
I
said, what is it you want, man? What is it you want? And I said, what I want is to talk to you alone without two dogs growling in my face. I'm not coming out. I said, well, come out if you want to know what I have. The information is very important to you. I wanted him to think that maybe someone in his family, some tragedy had happened, and he needed to know it. So that's the message I was conveying. So I turned around. It was a bluff. I was walking towards the San Pablo car, like, I'm leaving you. And all of a sudden, I turn around. He's on the other side of the gate. And the dogs are still behind the gate. I looked at him, and with complete compassion, I said, you know, I need your help, Armando. He started using the F word. What the F do you want with me? And I said, well, your friend Rick, I need to know his last name. F you. Look, Armando, please. He said, let me tell you something. And he's swearing every other word. My friend Rick, when he was in L.A., murders were happening in San Francisco. When he was in San Francisco, murders were happening in L.A. I know this. He's my friend. So I know he's not the Night Stalker. I said, well, it's not your job. It's my job. Give me the last name and we're good. You can go back in your house. F-U, you M-F. And he goes on and on. And so I pat him down. He didn't have any weapons. My partner, Carl, opens the back door. I place Armando into the back seat. Carl goes around. He's sitting behind the driver. The driver was the San Pablo detective behind the wheel. I get in on the passenger side in the front. So now I'm leaning over looking at Armando from the fire to getting into the car. I look across the street and there's 6-7 El Sobrante firemen standing out in front watching everything we're doing. So as I'm leaning over the seat, I said, Armando, we've been very kind to you. He says, F you, you put your MF hands on me. Who the F do you think you are? I said, Armando, none of this is necessary. All we're asking for is the last name. And I get another barrage of F you, you MF, and so forth. And I'm looking at him, and I guess in frustration, I had a fist sitting on the rest of the front seat, the top part. And he looks down at my hand. He goes, oh, tough MF, you want to fight? And his hands came up. His hands come up. I've learned instinctively, you're challenging me to a fight, and I'm not taking the first punch. When his hands came up, my right hand flew into the back seat. I hit him across the left eye, and he fell over onto my partner, Carl. Carl pushed him upright, and he dabbed underneath his eye. There was a half-inch cut. He dabbed on it. He looked at the blood. He said, look what you did to me, you mother effer. He says, is that as hard as you can hit? And his hands come up again. I said, no. I said, I'm going to be honest with you. It's the first time, I'd say thousands of interrogations, I had never used my hands or thought of using my hands. But by this time, we had been close to 2 weeks involved in this case with no sleep. And I was totally exhausted. I wasn't putting up with any more of his garbage. I said, I'm going to show you how hard I can hit. To this day, I'll never know if I was bluffing or not. I said, I'm going to split you from the top of your head. I called him Pretty Boy. He's a nice looking guy. I said, Pretty Boy, I'm going to split you from the top of your head all the way down to the crack in your behind. And I started over the seat looking like I'm going to throw the most powerful blow ever. And he threw up his arms and a cross. And he said, Richard Ramirez. Those two words broke open the Night Stalker case, solved our case, the 15 cases down in L.A., and also we were able to add on two more cases. We ended up with 5 murder victims in San Francisco. So we had cases in our end that we were able to clear up.
Wow, that's an incredible story. It's a part of the history of crime. You know, you were telling me how Richard Ramirez had really bad teeth. And look where you got the evidence that led to his arrest. Stolen property from the home of a dentist and a dental card with the name Rick on it. Kind of a poetic justice, no? I know that you had a face-to-face meeting with the Night Stalker. And a listener of our show from Newport Beach wrote to me to ask you this question. I was always wondering when Mr. Falzon was talking to the Night Stalker, if he could see and feel the evil in him.
You know, sadly, Armando, he ended up being a little Wilbur milquetoast. He was a wannabe. Ah. And the only thing that made Richard Ramirez what he was is when he was a deeply religious kid growing up as a Catholic. And then turned, when he started doing burglaries and cocaine, he became a devil worshiper, thinking that he was a devil's disciple, and the devil would protect him. If you remember, Richard Maris always had the pentagram on his hand. And when we found his apartment in the Tenderloin, he had a pentagram over his bed. He had the devil's protection. In his sick, demented mind, the devil was protecting him. And in order to worship the devil, he had to do horrible things. So that's why you saw the gouging of eyes, the brutal murders, the savage raping and harming of women. He was just a sick individual high on cocaine. Mm. And no, neither one of them had any mystic powers. They were two, in my opinion, two cowards, two bullies. The gun gave him the power that Richard Ramirez felt he needed.
The gun and the cocaine, it sounds like. Another lady, an angel mom from Southern California named Agnes Gibney, wanted me to ask you, how did your career change after this arrest? Do you have nightmares about these crimes?
My career covered 300 murder cases plus. And, you know, Yes, the Night Stalker was because he was probably one of the most prolific cases in the state of California's history. And it involved so many jurisdictions up and down the coast. And there were so many people living in fear, particularly for some reason, the Asian community, because Asians had been attacked in San Francisco and down in Los Angeles. So they felt he was looking for Asian people. So no, it doesn't hold any more importance in my life. The case that I think emotionally affects me the most would be Dan White.
Of course. And finally, I have a question from a gentleman in Texas, and he asks, how much extra time did Dianne Feinstein give you by publicly disclosing your investigation evidence? Did people die as a consequence of that disclosure?
Well, Dianne made a mistake. There's no question about it. Our chief gave to her how the link went down with L.A. and now his men were working the Night Stalker case and working with L.A. She should not have gone public with that. She was fine to say that the Night Stalker was in San Francisco, but yeah, to give out any information about the gun or the tennis shoes. But the thing about it is the two L.A. sheriffs, they downplayed San Francisco 100%. They never gave credit until pinned down on the Netflix series when one of the last questions is asked is, did San Francisco identify the Night Stalker? And the detective said, yes, they did. But up to that point, you said San Francisco to the media and they would immediately say, oh, their mayor blew it, hurt our investigation. So we weren't treated fairly. And I kept my mouth shut. My partner passed away. Richard Ramirez passed away. There's no reason to keep my mouth shut now. So I'm telling the truth.
Well, good for you. And I guess it's a turf war. It's always been a turf war between different departments. And Northern California, we don't like Southern California and vice versa, right?
I love the LAPD. I was very disappointed with these two lead detectives with the sheriff's department. Terribly disappointed.
So it was them in particular. Mr. Falzon, I could sit here all day with you and just enjoy talking forever, but unfortunately we do have some time constraints and I know that you're a very busy guy. But folks can learn a lot more about you and the kind of work that you did by reading your excellent book, 5 Henry 7. Where can people buy it and how can they learn more about you?
Well, the book has been a big hit. I have two boys, both in law enforcement, one with the FBI, another one, San Francisco police captain, two wonderful sons, and they both said, Dad, don't write a book. Cops can be condescending and cops can be critical. Don't put yourself out there. Well, I wrote the book anyhow, and it's been a huge hit. The San Francisco Great. Police Department has purchased 500 copies, and they're giving them to new recruits as a history and a textbook of what police work was like in the 70s and 80s. Wow. Besides that, we've had 5 or 6 documentaries and the Netflix series, 4-part. So we hit a home run the first time out of the box. My advice to your audience, the book is 5 Henry 7, and they can go on my website, which is Frank Falzon, FalzonON.com, or they can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon, and the book is $21.99, and everybody that reads it, we have a 5-star rating with over 117 reviews. So for a new release, I'm very, very proud of what we were able to accomplish. And like I say, the biggest hit is having police loving it.
Well, my wife, Mrs. Steele, is one of your greatest fans now. And I think the book was worth every penny and even the one that she bought for her dad. Frank Falzon, it's been a great honor to speak with you. I admire your life's work, and I only wish there were more men like you in law enforcement today. Thank you so much for coming on the AJ Steele Show. I wish you the very best.
Thank you, AJ, and same to you. It's been a pleasure.
All I really want to be is a guy that gets a girl. All I really want to be. All I really want to be is a guy that gets a girl.
AJ Steele Show, copyrighted 2023.